This week on the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast.
Again, don't write. Think. Work out your character. Work out scenes. Figure out how it's going to end.
Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, sneakers. Hope your writing is going well. This is a very special day for us here at the podcast for, I would say, at least three different reasons. For one, our interview guest today is one of my longest time standing writing buddies, a man with bestsellers going back 30 years, Philip Margolin. Number two, today is the official release date for my new novel, Splitsville, first book in a new series. Kinsey Rivera's life is shattered when she takes what she thinks will be a simple divorce case, only to see it become something much more deadly. Don't you hate it when that happens? And number three, I think today somebody is having a birthday, like maybe my sound engineer, Jesse Ulrich. Jesse, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I do now totally realize I forgot to play the countdown video. That was my bad. I'm sorry. It's been a day.
Just more editing for you. Well, That's true. Your birthday. I would hope you've been doing something fun or will later. What's the plan?
Well, I did go buy a new TV earlier today, which will be delivered next week. So I'm very excited to have an actual 4K TV to watch things on. So this should be fun for me, you know,
big
a week
time.
From now.
Yes. Is it a wall size screen or?
It's a 65 inch Sony.
Holy smokes.
Yes. I've measured the space out. We'll see. The problem is I'm competing with my father who wants a 75 inch screen. So I need something. Like, I was fine until he got that. And I'm like, well, now I need something.
I made the 4K jump when they did that Black Mirror episode where you needed Bandersnatch and you jumped around and and my computer wouldn't do it. So I thought my television wouldn't do it, rather. So I knew it was time to upgrade. Well, anyway, I appreciate you being here on this special day and happy birthday once again.
Thank you.
So my interview guest today, Philip Margolin, is not only a terrific author and a world traveler, but a terrific human being. His most recent book, A Matter of Life and Death, is the latest in a string of, by my count, 25 novels. Every single one of them, like from the first, has been a bestseller, including Gone But Not Forgotten, which I think is one of the best thrillers of all time, became a miniseries. The Last Innocent Man, which became an HBO movie. We will talk to him about his writing process and how he comes up with those killer plots. But first, the news. So for the first news story today, if you listen to the last podcast, you'll recall me talking about Talkia and how they generated an AI voice that was capable of persuasively reading your audiobook. Well, guess what? Google is now getting in the game, providing an AI voice that can, for no additional charge, read your audiobook. This could be a game changer, given Google's influence in the Android phone universe, the numerous people listening to audiobooks on their phones, and the fact that a lot of those are Android phones. I mentioned this because I know many Red Sneaker writers have struggled with figuring out how to break into audio. It's a very lucrative market these days, and this may be your opportunity. Jesse has put up a slide and I think a link showing you where you can check out some of these sample auto-recorded books. I listened to some, and I'm here to tell you, if I had not been told in advance this was an AI voice I was listening to, I wouldn't have known. I mean, once you know, you can maybe kind of detect a few moments of that kind of syntax, although not nearly that bad syntax, or gaps where a human voice might not have put them. But then again, it was a good voice, and there was an accent when I listened to Dracula. The voice did pronounce S-A-K-E, sake, and I think what the author meant was sake, but still, it is easy to listen to. This could completely change the whole audiobook universe, so you may want to check that out. Okay, story number two. The New York Times perhaps unwittingly stirred up controversy this week with a small passage in an article that was basically about all the changes in the traditional publishing world, but somewhere about halfway through was embedded this quote. About 98% of the books that publishers released in 2020 sold fewer than 5,000 copies. Lots of chat in cyberspace. Apparently, this burst a lot of bubbles that some people may have had, that getting a deal with traditional publishing means automatic big sales and big money. Well, sometimes it does, and our interview guest today is a testament to that. He's been doing fabulously well for 30 years, but does that always happen? No, it doesn't necessarily happen. We've got a few major legacy names. The truth is, the statement made in this article is not new. Most books lose money, and that became even worse last year, apparently, when there were no new major fiction breakout books. Sales were up for traditional publishers during the lockdown, but it was almost entirely backlist, which is always their strongest area. What this means long-term for traditional publishers' survival in a rapidly changing world, well, you can try and figure that out for yourself. Story number three, Simon & Schuster, which if you listen to this podcast regularly, you know is in the process of being purchased by Penguin Random House. They're launching a new imprint, Simon Element, which will focus on books in the lifestyle and practical nonfiction categories. They're going to publish their inaugural list next spring. Their CEO commented, quote, throughout its nearly century-long history, Simon & Schuster has published groundbreaking prescriptive nonfiction that transformed readers' lives. Well, what's noteworthy about this to me is that instead of just publishing a good book here or there, they've launched a new imprint, which suggests to me that they're seeing a growth opportunity. This sort of how-to, self-help, inspirational sector of the nonfiction market has not been doing all that well in the past few years, which is why there hasn't been that much activity there. I know a lot of the things that people used to buy books for, reference books. You know, I used to have this 12-volume motion picture guide. Who would have that now? You just go to Wikipedia when you want to know that kind of information. Or last year, my daughter decided she was going to learn to crochet. So did Alice ask me to buy a lot of books on how to crochet? No, she asked me to buy a lot of yarn and needles and stuff, but she watched YouTube videos to find out how to do it. Well, I know many of you out there are writing nonfiction, and particularly that kind of how-to or inspirational nonfiction. So here's a new marketplace for you in traditional publishing. And one last story, possibly the biggest news of them all, hardcovers are coming to Amazon KDP. Yes, KDP, that's Kindle Direct Publishing. That's where people go to self-publish their books. In the past, you've just been able to do ebooks and print paperbacks on a print-on-demand basis, but now they are adding a hardcover format. There's a beta test going on right now. I wasn't asked to participate, but I have talked to people who were, and they report being very pleased with the quality of the books that it generates. It has, you know, it's got a real weight and stiffness to it. It feels like a hardcover book. Now, there's no dust jacket. The cover is printed directly on, I mean, the art is printed on the hard front cover. On the other hand, that does seem to be what a lot of libraries and other markets, what they prefer today. And it definitely reduces the cost. So pretty soon you'll be able to add hardcover to the things you're offering, those of you who are in the self-publishing world. The question, of course, is whether there's going to be a market for it. in a book marketplace that is dominated by online sellers, one in particular, and more than 50% of all books are sold online, and at least in popular fiction, a huge portion of that is ebooks. So what's the impact? I don't know. We know Amazon has put major dents in traditional publishing as people have learned to shop online, and many authors have chosen, when they had options, to publish either with Amazon Publishing or to do it themselves through KDP. Well, when you can get ebook, paperback, hardcover, and audio from Amazon, that is perhaps going to make the choice to go somewhere else harder to explain. Now, to be sure, I am definitely not saying you should forego or not even consider traditional publishing. What I am saying is that you should make your choices based upon the current information and the current state of the industry, not perhaps romantic notions of the publishing world as it was one time in the past. But if you needed more reasons to consider traditional publishing, I will give you an author who has scored more than 25 best-selling novels in that world. And that, of course, would be our guest for this podcast, Philip Margolin. Phil, are you online with us? Ah, there you are. Thank you for being here.
Well, I appreciate you asking me. It was nice hooking up with you again. We seem to, every couple of years, we seem to get together. So this was really fun for me to have you ask.
Isn't that the way it always seems with writers? I mean, there's an event or something, fine. But yeah, I agree. Great to get back in touch. Okay, my traditional first question. If you could give a writer or aspiring writer one piece of advice, and I know you could give many, but if you had to narrow it down to one piece of advice, what would it be?
To send me 20% of your royalties. But no, actually,
now that's one we have not heard before.
Actually, I do have a piece of advice that I give new writers, and that is, when you know, all books start with an idea. Somehow you got an idea. It could be from a real life story that you read in the paper, or just something popped through your head. And my advice is, when you get that idea, absolutely under no circumstances should you write. You should think. Because what happens is, a lot of times you'll get this idea, and I'll give an example. There's a trainload of nuclear weapons going through Portland, Oregon on a train, and terrorists are going to take over that train. Wow, that's like the greatest idea ever. How exciting. And so I get excited, and I run home, and I open up my computer, and I start writing this incredible action scene with black helicopters in there and ninjas dropping down on the train and karate fights. It's the best action scene we've ever seen. And the terrorists take over the train, and then what? Who are these terrorists? Why do they want to take over the train? Who are the heroes? How are they going to get the weapons back without Portland blowing up? And so you haven't really thought about this, and you've got this really cool scene, but now where do you go? And then, because you didn't think, you get frustrated and you get writer's block, and then you crumple up your scene and you throw it in the garbage. Right. So
don't finish.
What I always do is, when I get an idea, I spend months sometimes just thinking it out until I've got an ending and some characters. And then I start working on an outline. And the ending is the most important thing. I won't write a single word till I know how things are going to end. And to show you I'm not lying, one of my best books is Executive Privilege. I got the idea for that book in 1995, Could the President of the United States Be a Serial Killer? And I didn't write that book until 2005, even though I was very excited by it. I couldn't figure out how it would end. So I had a little file where I periodically put ideas in from scenes or characters. But once it was finished 10 years later, it actually was one of my best books. So again, don't write, think, work out your characters, work out scenes, figure out how it's going to end, because I know you're going to be excited. You know, you're going to be so excited by this idea, but just rein it in, take a deep breath, and then do the hard work.
So you're a planner, not a pantser, or a discovery writer, sometimes people say.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. Yes, I'm very anal. I was a trial lawyer for 25 years. You've got to have everything in place.
Right.
And that's just my personality. But I was on a panel on Monday, and this came up. And there are people who just say, you know, if I'm going to be surprised, a reader will be surprised, and they just go and write. But really, I think it's a little bit of semantics, because what happens is they write, but then your first drafts are never very, very good. So you have to edit. So basically, I have a 25 to 40 page outline. They have a 400 page outline. Then they do their editing off of that. And I do my book off the outline and then do more editing. So I think, right. You know, if you're writing and writing, which I really think is a bad idea, but if you can get, I mean, the biggest problem with doing that is you get a great idea, you start writing, you have 400 pages and no ending. You know, so then you don't have a book, you have stuff. You know, you've got a stack of papers. It's not a book.
Or often I think people have in their minds how it's going to start and how it's going to end, because that's the exciting part. But it's that middle that they haven't worked out yet. And it's probably not going to come to you spontaneously either. I think that's the hardest part of the book to make interesting.
Well,
you know, not to have that mid-book sag. Go ahead.
No, I say one of the good things about an outline, my outlines take me about 1 to 3 months to write. So, yeah, so I'm sitting in my office talking myself through the book. So I'm not writing again. I'm thinking. And I'm spending 6 hours a day thinking about the plot. So I'm getting more ideas. I'm starting to see problems. Stuff I thought was going to be fabulous, I realize it's not very good at all. So, you know, I'm immersed in the plot and constantly getting new ideas for new characters. So that's what I like about the process of doing an outline. It gets you thinking again about what it's going to be like, who the characters, what are the situations. You get to spot flaws before you've written 400 pages and have to tear everything up because what you thought would just be great turns out, you know, oh my God, this really is not making a lot of sense. So, but that's just me. And I know there are a lot of people that they say this takes away spontaneity and et cetera, et cetera. And the good thing is, and I just want to lay this out, unlike mathematics, there is no formula for writing a book.
So, absolutely.
So any procedure that you have that gets you from page one to the end is brilliant.
So long as you get to the end. But I think your odds of that are a lot better if you've done some thinking in advance.
But like I tell people, you know, if this is a system that has worked for me, that doesn't mean it will work for you because everybody's different.
Right.
So if you don't like outlines and you can still get from page one to the end, then your system's just as good as mine.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to talk about, I'm going to take you back to the early days. It's been a while since your first book was published. I think that was Heartstone, right? Which was nominated for an Edgar Award. So not too sorry a way to start out, right? How did that happen? You were a practicing lawyer at the time, right? How'd you get your book published?
Yeah, my writing career is absolutely bizarre. When I was in the seventh grade as a result of an overdose of Perry Mason novels, I decided that the only thing I ever wanted to do when I grew up was murder trials. I want to be a criminal defense, not a lawyer, criminal defense lawyer and do murder trials. And that was the only thing. And for 25 years, that's what I did. I did 30 homicides, I did 12 death penalty cases, got to argue in the U.S. Supreme Court, everything I ever wanted to do when I was a kid. As far as the writing goes, though, I never, ever thought about being a writer. And the reason is I still read about 2 to 3 books a week. I'm just addicted to reading. And I started that in elementary school, so I was in awe of writers. And it just never occurred to me that I'd be smart enough to do anything like that. So I never thought about being a writer. And then I did college, 2 years of the Peace Corps in West Africa, and then came back to NYU Law School. And I worked my way through NYU Law School at night teaching junior high in the South Bronx. So really had no time to do anything except eat and breathe. But then something fabulous happened my last semester. To get through in 3 years like the day students, I had to go summers. And my last summer, my wife had graduated from college and got a job. So I didn't have to work that summer to pay the rent on her apartment. And I had a position working as the law clerk for the chief judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals. So I just had to get D's in my classes. I had three classes. D's. If I got D's, then I graduated and I could go to Oregon and work. So I had a free summer, which I'd never had. And I decided, I didn't know what to do with myself. I had always worked. But I said, I'm going to try to solve one of life's great mysteries, which is, how do those guys fill up 400 pages with words? And I would open these big books and I would say, how did this guy think up all this stuff? Because it seemed like impossible. So my project was to write a novel based on my experiences in West Africa, not to get published, because I didn't even know how you would do that. And not because I felt I had something I had to tell the world. I just want to know, could I write more than 25 pages? So 2 years later, I had a 189-page book, which I was very proud of myself. But when you're a lawyer, one of the big things you learn is to be objective and unemotional about your work. And reading the book objectively and unemotionally, I realized it really wasn't very good. But so I never tried to get it published, but it did make me fall in love with writing. So I messed around with that for a couple of years, maybe doing a short story every 2 years or something. And then when I was 1976, I actually got a short story published by a national Mike Shane Mystery Magazine, which was one of the big mystery magazines back in the 70s. And so I got some self-confidence. So I decided to write a novel, one that I'd be serious about. And when I was clerking at the Court of Appeals, I came across what I consider to be the single most amazing murder case in American history, not just Oregon. And I've done 30 myself. I've read true crime stuff like Helter Skelter. Nothing comes close to Peyton Allen. And since it was Oregon, there were very few writers. Now we have tons of writers in Oregon, but back in the 70s, there was hardly anyone. So I had this little gem all to myself. So I started writing, and I had five chapters and an outline done. Well, I'd only had one writing class. I had a C+ in creative writing my sophomore year in college. So I had no idea what I was doing. And out of the blue, I get a call from Marty Bauer. And Marty was a guy who roomed next to me at NYU Law School my first year. And we both started teaching school in our second year. And I think we had one class together. And then I lost track of him completely. And I hadn't seen him or talked to him about 4 years. So Marty calls me up out of the blue and says he wants to come to Oregon. He stayed in New York with his wife on vacation. I said, great, stay at the house and I'll take some time off and show you Mount Hood and the Columbia River Gorge. So when I picked him up at the airport, I said, hey, Marty, what have you been doing? And it turns out that Marty was one of the three lawyers for the largest literary agency in the world. Creative Management. I said, Marty, I'm writing a book. Marty said, oh, shit. Tried to jump out of the car. He actually was really nice. And I explained that I had no idea what I was doing, that I didn't have any, writing classes to tell me what you're supposed to do as a writer. And I said, could you take my five chapters back to New York and just show them to somebody at the agency and have them either call or write, say, hey, this is brilliant, keep going, or, it really stinks, go play golf or develop some other hobby. So weeks went by. I forgot that I'd given the chapters to Marty. And then one day I was in trial, and about 5:30, I come back from court. assuming everyone was going to be gone, and they're all the everyone in the office is sitting around with champagne. So I said, "What happened? Did someone win a case?" They said, "No, your agent called, which I didn't know I had one. They sold your book." And what happened was, yeah.
Wow.
So what happened was Marty liked the chapters. He gave it to a guy named Jed Mattis at the agency who had never sold a book. He was a secretary for an editor at Pocketbooks and decided he'd rather be an agent. So this was his very first time ever trying to sell a book. Marty said, "My friend in Oregon, wrote this, see what you can do with it." He liked the chapters and got the brainstorm of going to his old editor at Pocketbooks. And that's how I got my book contract. So it's literally, if he had asked me, should I go out and shop it? I would have said, "No, you're nuts. It's a rough draft. This is just like some, I haven't even, done second draft on it." But it just sort of fell on my head like like one of those pianos in those comedy movies where it drops on your head out of the sky. Yeah. So that's that was how. So my advice to young writers is go to law school, get really friendly with somebody.
That's a fantastic story. Clearly, it was meant to be. Hey, I want to remind everyone who's listening or watching while I think of it, please ask Phil questions, type them into the chat box, and we'll see what he has to say about them. In the meantime, I want to talk to you a little bit, Phil, about how you find and develop ideas. I don't know why this sticks in my mind, but for some reason, I remember you telling me about one of your books, the idea behind it. I want to say it's Burning Man. I'm not totally sure, but you were telling me that you started talking about this short story by Chekhov, and it's basically a redemption story. Somebody messes up, and then they come back later, and then you were doing the lawyer version of that, Undertaker's Wife, maybe one of those. I don't know. And I thought, wow, I just make stuff up, and he's getting his ideas from Chekhov. This is a classy guy.
I don't remember telling you that.
But now you did.
Read Chekhov again and see if I get some more ideas. No, the one I love to tell, I'll tell you about the one I love to tell about is the woman with a gun. But basically, I was on this panel and they asked me, what is the scariest thing for you? And writing for me is a snap. I mean, once I get my outline done, I start writing. But getting the idea is terrifying. I am always scared that I will never be able to get an idea for another book. And when you think about it, ideas are teeny weeny. They're this big. And a book is this big. So, I have to get an idea that's complicated enough and original enough to fill up 400 pages. And I'm always terrified that that's not going to happen. What I do to help me out is I keep an idea file. So I'm one of those guys that can't walk and chew gum at the same time. When I'm writing a book, that's what I'm doing. I'm not thinking about other books. So I have these cubby holes. I kept my law office to write it. So I have these cubby holes next to my desk where my computer is. And when I get an idea, like from a newspaper article or something pops into my head, I throw it into this cubby hole. And then when I finish a book, I take all of those pages, probably close to 1,000 pages of newspaper articles, articles from law journals, just notes that I've written myself. And I go through all of them and see if something sparks an idea. But the one I love to tell about, I was asked to keynote a writer's conference in St. Simon Island, Georgia, which is this really snazzy resort island. And there's an area called the Village on the island, and that's where they have boutiques and art galleries and, restaurants. And so I'd gone to Palmer's Village Cafe before going down to the writers' conference to get some breakfast. And this was owned by an art gallery owner. And so the walls were all decorated with photographs and watercolors, oils that were all for sale, you know, at the art gallery. So after I finished eating, I went into the bathroom to wash up, and over the toilet was the most amazing photograph I've ever seen. It's a black and white photograph. A woman in a wedding dress is looking out at the ocean. Her feet are where, you know, the water comes in and then stops and recedes. So she's standing there looking out at the ocean. And what makes it amazing is behind her back, she is holding a huge gun, which looks a little bit like a, I thought it was like Wyatt Earp. Oh, good. My daughter is just, my assistant who set up all this stuff. Okay. So,
and co-author, right?
We did a book together. So, Vanishing Act. So this is a photograph. And this was hanging over the toilet. Mm-hmm. And I said, what the hell is going on here? Did she just kill her husband on her wedding night? Is she going to shoot herself? Is she waiting for someone to come in from the ocean that she's going to shoot? So I ran out. I washed my hands first. I ran out. And I said, how much for that photograph? So it was, I think it was like $30. And then that gave me the idea for a book about a young woman who's just got her MFA, comes to New York to write the great American novel. She's got writer's block. She goes to the Museum of Modern Art on a lunch break. She's got this job as a receptionist at a law firm, which she hates. And she goes to the Museum of Modern Art, and there's this retrospective of the photographs of a very famous writer and, pardon me, photographer. And that photograph won the Pulitzer Prize. And it was of a woman on the evening when her husband was murdered on the evening of their wedding. So she goes to Oregon to try to find out, you know, about this case to write a novel about it. So it's art imitating life. Right. But that was my most fun. And that book, that photograph is in my office. And every day when I walk in, I see it. So
yeah.
They sold it to you. I believe that. Hey, can I have that picture that's in the men's room?
No, I was looking at this. I said, oh my God, this is an amazing photograph. So then I had to wow. get world rights to it. And they ended up getting money for the, for the book. And I had to make sure that the woman in the photograph was willing to sign off on it. But my agent put a clause in the contract for the book. They had to put that photo on the cover. So, and they did.
Really? Wow. Are you still, I know you still travel, you know, world travel for pleasure. You've just been to Egypt. Are you still doing as much of the, I mean, we used to bump into each other at conferences and signing. In fact, I think I met you for the first time when you came to Tulsa, and this would have been in the 90s, on some book signing event. You still do that sort of thing? Yeah. Or does that seem less important than it once did?
But they don't do the big. I used to do 26 cities in 6 days and in 6 weeks, and I loved it. But you know, they don't since 2008, when they had the recession or whatever that was. The publishers stopped doing the big tours. So I do. St. Martin's does send me out. I love St. Martin's. They've been really good to me. And They send me to some of the mystery books are like Poison Pen and Scottsdale. And my last tour, which was right when the pandemic broke. So March 9th was when a matter of, I think it's Reasonable Doubt was the one that came out in 2020. And I did Poison Pen with Humans, Houston Murder by the Book with Humans, another major bookstore in Dallas with Humans, and then boom, everything canceled. So, but I have to tell people, I've done this over the years. The time when you came up to me, and I can't remember Barnes and Noble, wherever I was doing the signing.
It was a local store called Novel Idea, which sat anymore.
I tell people, this is one of the great things that ever happened to me on a book tour. Because usually when you're on these tours, you go to the bookstore, you're there from like 7 to 9, and then you just get back to your hotel and you're really tired and just read or watch a little TV and they hunk out. But Bill, you came over with your kid and I think your wife, and you introduced yourself. And I had read some of your books, I think, and we were talking. And then you said, do you want to come back to my house for cake and coffee? And that's one of the few times that has ever happened to me on a book tour. And it was like a highlight because it's so nice to just be at someone's house instead of in some, hotel room. So I over the years, I've told people about that.
Agree. You know, what I remember best is that you had an escort, assigned by the publisher, drive you around. And I said, I'll take him back to the hotel. I'm going to take him over to my place. The guy's like, and you are? Can I see some ID? Phil, we got some questions coming in from the people who are watching. This probably relates back to when we were talking about outlining and planning and thinking. Somebody, this is Karen, who's a writer herself. She's asking, do you use writing software to outline?
I just use my fingers. I just type it on the computer. And I'm sort of a techno idiot. Fortunately, I'm in the law office with people that know how technology, because I'm always hitting something on the computer that wipes out, the page that I've written. So I run out in a panic, and there's one guy in the office. Can you come in? Can you come in? I just erased half my novel. So he'll come in and press two buttons, right, and they'll all pop back up and stuff. But no, I don't use any software.
Okay, here's another question. This is from Rick, who is also a published author. You're drawing out the big guns today. He's asking, what are some of the things he does now while writing? He meaning you. What are the things you do while writing that you never did when you first started? Or conversely, things that you did when you started that you don't do anymore?
You know, I'm in a rut. I'm still writing the books exactly the way I did back in 1974 or 70, 76, I guess, is when I started on Hearthstone. I have this system that I developed. My first five novels were published while I had a full-time law practice and raising two little kids with my wife. So I had to develop a system that I could fit in. Most of the writing was on the weekends and the mornings. And I still do the same old thing. I'm not very creative with my work habits. I get in it. I go to my office my daughter sometimes tells me she thinks I'm a high functioning autistic, which might be true. But every morning I get up around 6:30. Get some breakfast, go to my office, buy a grande non-fat caramel latte, do the New York Times crossword, check my emails, and then start writing. And that if there was the coffee bar closed for remodeling for a week several years ago, and I was just in a panic as to how I was going to write anything. But
that blew the whole thing.
And then I take my outline and I look at my outline and I see, where am I? And then I write, and I put about 11:30. I work out for an hour or I go out to eat lunch, and then I come back and I do some more stuff till about 3 or 4. And it's the same every single day. That's my routine. And I don't write on vacation, and I don't write when I'm traveling. So
it seems to work for you. You've had at least two that I can think of books adapted into some kind of film project. Gone But Not Forgotten became a miniseries. The Last Innocent Man became what I thought was a really good movie. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was really interesting. The two were extremely different experiences. So with Gone But Not Forgotten, with HBO, The Last Innocent Man, they filmed it in Portland. HBO, it was Ed Harris and Roger Spottiswood, who was one of the top directors at that time, and had an all-star cast. I've been told it was the first HBO movie that was done in-house. This was 1986, six before they had been farming them out to production companies. And so they put a lot of money into it. It was filmed in Portland, and I got a part in the movie, which was tons of fun. I got to be the jury foreman in the big murder case. So I delivered the
cameo.
Yeah, and I should have gotten an Oscar, but I was stabbed in the back. You know, there's so much politics in Hollywood. So, but it was loads of fun. I got very friendly with the producer, and he let me listen to the sound equipment, and I came in for daily. So I was really involved. I set up the chess scene in the very first scene in the movie. David Suchet, who was Poirot on TV, was playing Ed Harris a game of chess in Harris's law office, and they called me up like really early on Sunday and said, nobody here knows how to play chess. Can you come down? Yeah. And I used to be a competitive chess player. So can you come down and set up the board? So I found a very famous old game, and I showed them what moves they were supposed to make. And that was fun. So I did a lot of stuff. The ending of the movie and the ending of the book are different. And they asked me, which one do you think's better? And I actually thought Dan Bronson wrote a brilliant screenplay. And I said, use the screenplay because it's where I think it works better in a movie. The other one, Gone But Not Forgotten, they never even told us they were filming the movie.
What?
My publisher wanted to do a movie tie-in book. They never talked to him. We learned that they were filming it when some agent who represented actors called my agent up and said, who's doing this? And she says, who's doing what? I said, well, they're filming Phil's movie, book. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And then they told us it wasn't going to be on TV because it was a Hallmark channel. And I don't know if you guys have ever watched the Hallmark channel, but Gone But Not Forgotten is really freaky.
I know the book is.
And when I heard the Hallmark was going to do it, I said, huh. Because I love, Murder, She Wrote, and the Dick Van Dyke
and
murder stuff. I used to watch that. I said, maybe they're trying to get a new, expand their audience or something. This really doesn't sound Hallmark. Then what I heard was that their censors got a hold of it and freaked out. And they said, we can't put this on Hallmark Channel. And then I heard that they were not going to try to sell it to another channel, and that it was going right to DVD. So I was a little bit upset because I wouldn't have sold it to them if I knew that was wrong. And then Mother's Day comes along, and my son calls me up, and his in-laws were in Florida, and he said, Dad, did you know your movie's going to be on Lifetime, where they torture women all the time? So I said, well, no. He said, yeah. My mother-in-law just called me up and said it's on Lifetime this week. And it actually turned out that they did a very good job. Brooke Shields stars in it. And it also had a really good cast. And I got a possessory credit, which is usually it's just Gone But Not Forgotten. And then somewhere later on, there's a little thing said based on a novel. But this was Philip Margolin's Gone But Not Forgotten. So every time they went to commercial break, it would say, next, Philip Margolin's Gone But Not Forgotten. So it worked out great, but I had no participation whatsoever.
Got another question here from Sherry, who I know to be a terrific writer who won several awards last year at WriterCon. And she's asking about your writing routine and wants to know approximately how long does it take to create the final draft, the one you hand in to your agent?
Yeah, I mean, again, the biggest problem is getting the idea. So once I get that idea, which could take months, then I do the outline. The outline usually takes me 1 to 3 months. And then the first draft is usually about 6 to 8 months. And then I do a lot of editing. I do tons of self-editing before I send it into New York. And I usually send Jennifer Welch is my fabulous agent at the Jean Nagar Literary Agency. Jean was my agent from 1984 until she retired. Jennifer's her daughter, and they were both amazing. And Jennifer is a phenomenal editor. She's really great. So I send my draft to her first because when I send the book to St. Martin's, Keith Kale is my editor there, and he's very, very good. But I like to give as complete a book as possible, so there's, you know, they don't have to do a lot of work with it, hopefully. So 1 to 3 months for the idea, for the outline, 6 to 8 months for the draft, and then another month or so rewriting for quality. So maybe a year and a half before it goes into the into New York. And I'm always working on, like, there's dead for the, a lot of people don't know. So let's say Keith Kale just sent me the notes for the what I think will probably be the final draft of the Darkest Place, which is my next Robin Lockwood book. So okay, and so let's say I get it back to him in a couple of weeks, and he said this is what we're going to publish. The book's not going to come out till March of next year. So rather than sit around and twiddle my thumbs while he's got the book in New York editing, because it'll go to New York and then he'll take, you know, a while to edit it, I start on the next book. So I sort of try to make sure that I have at least 100 pages of the next book done by the time the one comes out in March.
I want to ask you a little bit about your most recent book, A Matter of Life and Death, which I think just came out a few months ago, March, sure. Right? Where did that come from? What's that about?
Okay, so the impetus for that, I did 12 death penalty cases. And death penalty cases are different from all other cases, criminal or civil. And that includes regular murder cases where death is not a possible sentence. And I learned that sort of the hard way. I had done about 15 murder cases when Oregon got the death penalty back. And I was saying, oh, you know, this is just like another murder case with a little more serious, you know, sentence. And then much to my horror, I realized that it was an incredibly different thing, because when normally if a client is convicted of a crime, any crime, there is a couple of months between the jury finding guilty and the sentencing hearing. But in a death case, the sentencing hearing happens immediately, because the jury that finds the guy guilty of aggravated murder has to also decide whether the client should be A, executed, B, given life without possibility of parole, or life with the possibility of parole. And they have to hear the case immediately so that they're not, you know, if there was 2 months, all sorts of horrible things could come in and taint their decision. So when you get a death case, you have to do what you normally do in a trial, try to convince the jury that he didn't do the actual crime. But then you also have to prepare for this sentencing hearing. And if the guy is convicted of aggravated murder, then the jury knows that he did something awful. And a lot of times it's really awful if it's an aggravated murder case. So you have to humanize your clients so that they don't kill him. And so you do a biography from the day the guy was born till the day of the trial. You get all sorts of expert witnesses. And so you're really preparing for two cases at once. And sometimes the sentencing hearing is longer than the actual trial. And so I thought it'd be interesting for readers to see what it's like to try a death penalty murder case, or, you know, from someone who's actually done it. And so it involves a homeless man who he's a former professional boxer and a short order cook, and he is in love with his wife and has a wonderful daughter, but he doesn't have a job and he can't get one. They have no money. They're living in a homeless in a tent in an area that homeless people are living in, and he gets baited into fighting in a no holds barred illegal fight and kills the guy that he's fighting. And so he's on trial. So he's then set up to the people that run the fight say, we've got a film of this and we'll go to the cops unless you do what we tell you to. And then he goes in and is told to burglarize his house. But when he goes in, there's a dead body, and it's the wife of a very prominent judge. So the reader knows he's been set up. But, Robin Lockwood, who's my heroine in my latest series, she worked her way through Yale Law School by fighting on pay-per-view events, mixed martial arts, UFC events in Las Vegas on TV. And so she's not only a brilliant lawyer, but she also was a professional fighter herself. So she knows this guy from the gym where they both used to work out. And she's convinced the guy didn't do it, but all of the evidence and tons of evidence points to him being guilty. So that's the problem she's facing. How do you get this innocent guy, acquitted or at least not sentenced to death? So that's a long-winded answer to your short question.
No, it sounds terrific. Books have been, and I'm sure they always will be. Bill, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. This was loads of fun.
All right. Just a few parting words before we sign off. Tell all your friends, Splitsville is now available everywhere you buy books. Some of you will remember when John Lesquois was the podcast guest, he mentioned they had a new music CD coming out. Well, guess what? It's out. It's called Demos and Covers, and it's available now. You can listen to it. You can buy it. You can stream it on Spotify. Jesse's putting up a link, and I'll put the link in the show notes for those of you who are listening to this. Check out John's new album. I also want to mention my Patreon campaign, patreon.com/willburn. That's patreon.com/willburn. That's how we finance the podcast. We don't take advertising. We take contributions from patrons. And I want to do a shout out to Lois Melbourne, who this week made an extremely generous contribution to the Patreon account. She said that the sign-off I do on this show, if you don't know what I'm talking about, you're going to hear it in about 30 seconds, but it meant a lot to her and kept her writing. She wanted to give something back and very much appreciated Lois. If others would like to do the same, go to patreon.com/willburn, first four letters of both names, and you can sign up. Next time, my guest will be Sharon Jenkins, who you may recall I said was going to be on before, but due to my inability to maintain a coherent schedule, that's been delayed. But we're going to do it next week on June 1st. That's Tuesday, a special occasion. And you'll want to be there for this very special interview. Subscribe to my YouTube channel so you always know whenever we're going to live stream, and you can find any episodes that you've missed. Until next time, keep writing. And remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit. See you next time.